jasoncharles.net.
Deep talk, deep sounds.
I am the East Village.
On jasoncharles.net.
Hello and welcome to another episode of I on the East Village on jasoncharles.net podcast network. This is Alex Carpenter and I'm with Megan Hayward filling in for Evie Grieve here on East 12th Street at Megan's shop East Village Vintage Collective with a very special guest today. A longtime East Village resident and prolific cartoonist, designer, author and founder publisher of Punk Magazine, John Holmstrom. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
We want to get into all of your various achievements and your history in the neighborhood, but we thought we'd just start out with a little overview of your association with the East Village, going back to the mid-70s and the beginning of the CBGB punk movement, where you were a central figure, essentially creating the now legendary Punk magazine in 1975. Can you talk a little bit about those early years when you first came to the East Village and established yourself here?
Sure. I came to New York City to attend the School of Visual Arts. So the first 5 years, I went there for 2 years, but the first 5 years I lived in New York, I lived in 10 different places. And then finally in 1977, I found my current apartment. And then 79, the prices went up, they skyrocketed. So I've been stuck in my apartment ever since. I moved in with the money I made from a rocket to Russia.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And you've been there ever since.
And that's on 10th Street, I believe.
I live on 10th Street. Before that, I lived above Stromboli's Pizza.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great pizza place.
Yes, yeah. We love Stromboli's.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, I lived across the street from the Hell's Angels.
On 3rd Street?
Yeah.
3rd Street? Yeah.
Right directly across the street. And they'd wake you up at 5 in the morning with their motorcycles.
Yeah, that was sad to hear recently that building was converted. And you know, there was a lot of talk in the neighborhood about that.
How do you feel New York has, East Village, I guess, in particular, has changed in the time you've been here?
Yeah, well, you ever seen that book, St. Mark's is Dead?
Yes.
Yeah, that describes the city. I remember I came here in high school. Our English teacher took us to the public theater to see Waiting for Godot.
Oh.
And they were like, whatever you do, don't run away or we'll never be able to do another field trip.
Right.
And there was some diner on like Astor, where the Cube is now. And
yeah.
The locals were like, oh, the neighborhood's never going to be the same. The diner's closing. It's all over, you know.
Right.
So, you know, it's changed a lot. But I came here when the hippie thing started. I saw Jimi Hendrix and Harlem Boys Choir opened at the Fillmore East on New Year's Eve.
Wow.
And I just loved it. Like, you could just walk down the street and buy underground comic books or underground books, music. There were clubs everywhere. It was clothing stores. It was an amazing time to be in New York.
Yeah.
The 60s into the early 70s.
It's funny, isn't it? Like you see change happen and it's hard to tell at the time if it's just the diner that you loved has closed and you're sad or if it's actually a positive change that may down the track lead to something great again. So, you know, that's always the challenge I find when something changes. Is it just my nostalgia for the old thing or is it actually a bad change?
Yeah, well, when I first came here, people were not nostalgic about this place.
Right.
The hippie thing didn't fit in well in New York.
Right, right.
The hippies hated New York. Mm-hmm. If you ever heard, you have the album upstairs, Country Joe and the Fish.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Harlem song is like the most racist, offensive, anti-New York City song you've ever heard, except for the other song on the album, The Streets of Your Town.
Mm-hmm.
He says, the subway is not the underground. I like that group, but the anti-New York thing was ridiculous. But that's how people wanted to go back to nature and live in the woods and start a commune.
Right.
So those of us who came here in the early 70s when crime was becoming rampant and the drugs were everywhere and New York City was falling apart. You know, we weren't paying attention to that part of the culture. You know, we were ready to start our own anti-hippie kind of movement.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for that.
Yeah. I like everybody, but, you know, I have to say I've never really thought of New York as a home for hippies. It doesn't really feel like it's the vibe. But I also like the fact that that's the thing about New York is that there's always been all different types of people and all different types of music going on, that one thing kind of springs into the next thing.
Well, John Lennon discovered David Peel when he's performing in Washington Square Park. And they bring out a record called Have a Marijuana.
Right.
And
right.
It actually sold a lot of copies at first. And, you know, Danny Fields lived here. And so many people involved in the music industry. But but until the 70s, until the CBGB scene, people didn't think of New York City as a music town anymore.
Right.
You know?
Right.
You didn't have, the Velvet Underground were considered a flop.
Yeah,
the New York Dolls went nowhere. And even though we love those bands, the industry kind of wrote off New York City.
Right.
It really took punk rock, the bands like the Talking Heads, Ramones, Blondie, it took them years to get off the schneid and get a hit record.
How did you first get involved with doing artwork for the Ramones and just that scene in general?
I was always a fanatic for music. Like in the late 60s, early 70s, me and my high school friends would hitchhike all over the country to see the rock festivals. When I came to New York, the Dolls were happening. And I would always like not eat a meal to raise money for a ticket to see somebody. And then my first job was at a place called the New Fillmore East Theater. So the place where I saw Hendrix, I was doing posters for, but it was a very short amount of time. I think the new owner ran up against the bad guys he borrowed money from. He's found dead under mysterious circumstances.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, you'd think I'd be smart enough to stay out of the music industry after that.
It just makes it more exciting.
But, you know, then I was working for Will Eisner after going to the School of Visual Arts, but he closed his office for the summer. And then this kid I knew, Eddie McNeil, was making a movie in our hometown. And so we made the movie, and then I told Eddie and his friend Jed about punk rock, and I brought the Dictators record, and everybody went nuts for this whole new wave of music that I was seeing happen. And Jed ran this house painting business and had a few thousand dollars, and he got bored going to school and said, hey, let's start a business. So we found a storefront and started a magazine and saw the Ramones were playing CBGBs. So we went down to CBGBs for an interview, and they were terrible. You know, the Ramones were so uptight. And then Danny Fields, their manager, says, Lou Reed's in the audience. Would you like to talk to him? I was a huge Velvet Underground fan. I'd seen Lou at the Academy of Music, Rock and Roll Animal. And I was ready for him. This was like an amateur getting in the ring with Rocky.
Right.
I mean, he was the heavyweight champion of interviews. But he let me hang around, and he was Lou Reed all the way and gave me this great interview. He had just brought out a record called Metal Machine Music, which was a double album of feedback noise. No music, just... I loved it, and we wrote about it glowingly. And this actually helped Lou win his lawsuit because his manager sued him for putting that record out.
Oh, wow.
Claiming he only did it to break his contract, which I think he did. Yeah. But it was a great record.
He's not going to do it badly.
So, bring out the first issue, and it was actually printed on Green Street, just below Houston Street at a place called Perez Printing.
I was wondering where you were doing your printing at that time. That's interesting.
And okay. Once we had the first issues put together, we brought them over to CBGB's, and they started selling them at the door. I think Roberta Bailey was probably at the door and enabled us to sell the magazine at CBGB's. We didn't sell that well in New York. Mm-hmm. We did send them all over the country and even to Australia. Mm-hmm. But our biggest market was London by far.
Okay.
They at the time, they had three separate newspapers that came out on a weekly basis, all devoted to music. And they'd published a lot of stuff about the scene. And then when we came out, they were really excited. And as Captain Sensible, the drummer of the Damned, said in something he wrote for Vice magazine, the English punks would pick up the magazine and then try to imagine what a band like Blondie sounded like based on the pictures.
Right, right.
Because nobody had a record out yet.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I wonder, what did they think Blondie sounded like?
2 hours of feedback.
I love that first Blondie record, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it was funny, you know, Television was the band all the critics loved in New York.
Yeah.
And then Blondie went on tour with Television. Mm-hmm. And I think Television figured out that, you know, nobody's going to like them. We're going to go over great. Instead, Blondie blew them off the stage every night. All the critics love Blondie and the fans love Blondie. Mm-hmm. It's one of those rare instances in rock and roll when the opening band, like, kicks ass and takes over.
Right, right.
But someone said they saw Blondie last summer, and it was one of the best shows they ever saw.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're very underrated as musicians.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Their music's amazing. Their loft used to be on the Bowery. I think it's 120 Bowery.
Oh, okay.
So they would just, like, drag the equipment up to CBGB's.
Oh, cool.
The Ramones lived at 6 East 2nd Street at Arturo Vega's loft.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So they could just walk downstairs to play CBGB's.
I saw in the movie that when the Talking Head, in the CBGB movie, that when the Talking Heads were on stage, they said, "We live across the street."
Yeah, that was the intro.
They lived on Talking Heads Street. They lived down the street from everybody lived close by.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, speaking of that, CBGB and Punk Magazine, I wanted to say congratulations on issue number 22 of Punk Magazine.
Yeah.
This is the first issue, right, since 2008?
Yeah, we did a CBGB tribute when it was closing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's dedicated, this newer one is dedicated entirely to Iggy Pop.
Yes.
And it's available only through Iggy Pop's website.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about how this latest issue came to be and why it's distributed that way?
Yeah, the record producer called up Roberta Bailey, who took a lot of photographs for the magazine and was our photo editor and was just the best person to work with, really brought up the professionalism of the magazine. And he had been buying photos from Mutant Monster Beach Party from her. You know, and that was this photo comic we did with Joey Ramone and Debbie Harry and Andy Warhol. But he liked the surfing Joey pictures. There's pictures of Joey with a surfboard at Coney Island, you know, shooting the tube. And he said to Roberta, "Well, you know, I'm thinking, I just did the new Iggy Pop album and we're thinking of doing a print thing with it." And she said, "Oh, you should call John Holmstrom. He's a good cartoonist." And he called me a couple days later and laid out, "Do a new issue of Punk, all about Iggy. We'll take care of the printing." And it was a lot of fun to research the life and times of Iggy Pop.
I bet.
He's had an amazing career, and I respect him more than just about anybody in the world. And like I say in the magazine, he was the first punk. You know, they call him proto-punk. It makes me sick.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, I mean, he took all the chances.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, very much so. And now he's in Florida, right?
He loves Miami.
Yeah.
He does a song about it on the album.
Yeah.
The New Atlantis.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's sinking under the ocean.
So tell us, if people want that issue, is it is still available, right?
Oh, yeah, it's still available. But they did a very limited edition.
Yep.
So if you want to get it, I would get it soon. I think it'll be a collector's item. down the road, like most of our issues. Yes. They printed it on this ridiculously expensive paper, so it looks amazing.
Yeah, right.
And comes with a CD. They had a package with the vinyl, but that sold out like immediately.
Yeah, that's. I think that's what led me to ask if it was still available. I think I saw that the record had sold out.
I personally think it's Iggy's best solo album.
Is that right?
Yeah. The producer's just great. He did a track with Ozzy, with Jeff Beck on guitar. And my friend Mike Wartella worked on the video. Ozzy and Jeff Beck together, right? It's amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I miss Jeff Beck so much.
Yeah.
I bet.
He's working on a new album that's supposed to come out with Morrissey.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
He's done Miley Cyrus.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Elton John.
The whole gamut.
This is beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How long did all this take to put together?
Andrew called me the end of July, and they wanted it in mid-October. But, yeah, I was, like, working on publicizing it and mailing out copies in January. So it was, like, a six-month project.
So, talking about, obviously designed a lot of, other than punk, a lot of other magazine covers like Heavy Metal, High Times, and the 70s classic Bananas. You also created and illustrated many record covers and posters for a lot of iconic founding, really, New York punk artists like Iggy Pop and the Ramones. How did that all come about?
Well, I never did a record cover for Iggy.
Okay.
But I did the label.
Yes.
Like when Chris Stein was running Animal Records, he hired me to hand letter the all the track information for the single and the album. So that was kind of cool to work on. I did more record labels than covers for a while. I did a record label for the first punk compilation by Rhino, the DIY series, and I did one for Adrenaline OD, a hardcore band. They did a song called Theme from an Imaginary Midget Western.
Sounds like you're always getting involved with interesting projects, and it's you never quite know what you're going to be doing.
Well, I'm a cartoonist,
and
I grew up in the underground, you know, R. Crumb and Gilbert Shelton and all that crazy stuff. So I'm weird.
Yeah. Well, join the club.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people who may not even be aware that they've seen your work, because, I mean, there's the amount that you've produced is just pretty incredible.
Well, I've slowed down now. I'm pretty old. But my latest accomplishment really is the Metropolis store.
Yes.
It's a big vintage clothing store.
Yes.
And they put up a little John Holmstrom dressing room in the back.
We heard about that. Yeah. And it's funny that you're bringing this up, because that's what I was going to talk to you about next, is our mutual association with the vintage community and your long association with Richard Colligan and Metropolis Vintage, one of the neighborhood's most iconic vintage stores. And you have done the design for the Metropolis logo.
For the signs, the signage.
I personally love Metropolis. I've been shopping there for many years before I was able to open my own store. I know they're the mecca for vintage t-shirts, and I'm always amazed with the selection that they have. And we actually learned more and got to know Richard a little bit more during the pandemic. And he was very helpful and cool. And like, I felt like the community really came together a little bit more, because we were all trying to figure out how we were going to stay afloat. And he was going to rallies and getting on meetings with the local merchants association, which we're involved with. And it was a terrible time, but it was nice to get to know people like that a little bit more and feel like we all came together as a even more of a community. But
I've noticed that about the vintage clothing community.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cooperative attitude among all the people. Like Richard puts together small conventions where everybody sells vintage stuff.
Yeah.
He's got a postcard he gives out in the store showing every vintage clothing store in New York.
Oh, we made that.
Yeah, that you might be the one
well,
that we made.
Well, if it's the one that we made, maybe
unless
not.
Unless he does a different
maybe
one.
Maybe he does a different one. But we made him. No, he. I know which one you're talking about. You're talking about New York Vintage Map. We don't make that one. But he has posted and helped us spread the word about the East Village Vintage Map, which we made.
Right.
And you're right. It's, you know, I mean, the thing is, it's that the as vintage store owners, I mean, pretty much most of us know that you're going to go to every store and find something different, mm-hmm. which is what, you know, makes vintage cool and is one of the things that me personally got me into it. And I think that's one of the cool things about Richard is that it seems like he's, you know, he's so passionate about it. And
yeah.
He cares, you know.
Biggest right. collection of Ramones and Cramps t-shirts
yeah.
ever.
That, yeah. I gotta say, I'm jealous of that.
Yeah. You've got a pretty good collection, I gotta say. Of rock t-shirts.
Well, but
yes, you do.
Nothing
she calls
like,
it her retirement.
Yeah.
I have the biggest collection of John Holmstrom merchandise.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm jealous of that too.
John Holmstrom and Punk Magazine stuff.
Yeah. That's yeah. cool. Back when I started. I mean, I think I was influenced, fashion for me was influenced by music. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, I like punk music. How do I dress like that? How do I be different? How am I different? So I just think there's such a relationship between music and fashion. And I think vintage has kind of always been a part of that.
Well, no, if you get into like the punk rock CBGB scene,
mm-hmm.
and an important part of that was the clothing stores back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Trash and Vaudeville
yes.
was our first advertiser. Your
oh,
Ray
wow.
Goodman is
okay.
still open. He just
yes.
moved the store to 7th Street.
Yes.
He kind of had vintage stuff,
mm-hmm.
yeah. you know?
Yep, he did.
That's where people would buy an old leather jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And Manic Panic opened up.
Mm-hmm.
The Late Show was on St. Mark's Place. Then it turned into Revenge, and the Revenge Girls were like a whole wacko mm-hmm. part of the English punk scene influencing New York City.
Oh, okay.
So you always had like clothing stores and record stores mm-hmm. and like a whole underground economy.
Right.
That's what was so great about the scene back then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, like we were able to exist because there were so many other businesses and so many people hanging out.
Working together.
Yeah.
It's not like it once was, but there's still a lot of cool places and, you know, interesting things to see around the neighborhood and
right.
a lot of vintage shops.
They're not on St. Mark's
no.
anymore.
No, they're not.
But I remember in the 90s, that was like the real heyday of
mm-hmm.
that punk rock thing. Because you had Coney Island High,
mm-hmm.
the Continental, CBGBs. People would run back and forth between the two clubs to see different bands. You
uh-huh.
know, Max's was CBGBs and Max's before then.
Right.
And they had all these great record stores.
Mm-hmm.
So I would spend weekends, go to Tower Records, see
mm-hmm.
what they got. Go
yeah.
to, I think it was called Rocket Scientist was on
mm-hmm.
St. Mark's Place.
Mm-hmm.
There was that big used CD place.
Kim's.
I think it was Norman's.
Oh, and then Kim's.
On the Bowery.
Kim's
yeah,
video.
Kim's was yeah. awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
And Richard, you know, he got very lucky. He told me that new store, he used to be on the 3rd Avenue,
Third,
below
yeah.
10th.
Mm-hmm.
His new place is like 4 or 5 times bigger.
Yes.
And he's opened up the downstairs.
Oh, I didn't realize
and
that.
And he's not paying that much more.
Oh, okay.
Than,
cool.
than
great.
He was for the rent at the old place.
Oh, great.
So,
I mean,
oh, yeah, yeah.
That's it's, amazing.
He's great. He really, he takes
yeah.
great care of me and other people, and his employees are all very happy.
Yeah.
He apparently is a great boss to work for.
Yep.
That's what we've heard.
But yeah, you know, speaking of the good bosses, Hilly was a great boss.
Oh, yeah.
I heard a lot of stories. Like, I heard about one guy developed a drug habit. And most bosses would just fire the guy and get someone else. But he kind of helped the person get over the drug habit and
mm-hmm.
kept his job. And
I've watched the CBGB movie, which you also worked on. And it was hard to tell from that what kind of a boss he was. So it's interesting to hear
well,
that.
Well, they had the early Hilly.
Right, right.
I think
yeah,
early
yeah,
Hilly.
Yeah.
Hilly
was the beginning
got
of the club.
Mellower yeah. with time.
Makes sense.
Because I remember I used to stop by all the time and talk to him. He'd be sitting at the front door, and I'd just stop by. And
uh-huh.
He was telling me about how they're trying to kick him out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He was getting hassled by the fire department and all kinds of
yeah.
agencies. They were out to get him.
I bet. They needed some. They needed money, and they needed someone to be the fall guy, and all of that. I'm sure. So he seems like he battled with a lot to make that club successful. And I know that a lot of bands. He was very good to a lot of bands, from what I heard, and gave them a lot of, you know, a chance.
Well, not all of them.
No.
I don't want to say bad stories, but I was going to say there's a punk rock museum opening in Las Vegas
on
April Fool's Day.
Okay. Yeah, cool.
Perfect. And it kind of angers me because here in New York, the city completely ignores punk rock, which started here, you know, like if you're involved in hip hop, they have all kinds of goodies for you to you know, promote that culture. But boy, they hate us.
I remember a while ago there was that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame annex.
Oh, wow. That failed.
Yeah. And
miserably.
I remember they had pieces of CBGB's bathroom in the exhibit at the end. I remember they had a special exhibit
at
one
awning.
Point. Okay, that's I remember it was something.
Well, the CBGB movie had like some of the toilets and the jukebox and the phone booth and part of the bar.
Yeah.
And they invited me down when they filmed.
Oh, okay.
And I swear there were moments when I felt like I was back at CBGB's.
Wow, they were.
You know, there's Blondie or the Talking Heads.
Uh-huh.
Or the Ramones. I saw all three bands
at
this other CBGB's. There's Hilly. Everybody was dressed in 1970s clothing.
Wow.
It was a great experience being involved in the film. And I know there are people who don't like it, but being a cartoonist, I love the fact it's a light comedy instead of a depressing, dark drama.
Right,
you know.
Right.
So. I agree. I think there were. I loved the movie, and I thought it was a cool take on the whole situation. And I feel like there, of course, with everything, there's a lot of negative things you could focus on, but it definitely felt like it focused on the positive. And I think in doing that, it made you learn a little bit more about and pay more attention to the bands and what was going on with the whole story.
Well, I heard people say, oh, I want to see Patti Smith and the Ramones. There's not enough of them in it. But, you know, Terry Ork is the guy who built that place.
Right.
He's the guy who went to Hilly and said, hey, I'm going to guarantee you're going to get a big crowd. And he'd buy drinks for everybody.
Yeah.
And he put out the television record, the first 45 by them. I mean, it was and Merv.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they got so much right about the real inner workings of the club, and all that stuff about the Dead Boys was real.
That's so interesting. And I didn't realize that until watching the movie. And I also I thought it was funny at the end, the part about Merv always wearing a hard hat.
Yeah, he did.
And no one knew why.
Well, he was the bouncer.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense.
Merv's job was to make sure the people who got too drunk got into a cab and hopefully got home. Home safe.
Right.
It's not an easy job at CBGB's, I'm sure.
Oh, he was a sweetheart, Merv.
Yeah.
We touched a little on the clothing stuff in Metropolis, but let's talk about the clothing line that you have in Japan. Can you tell us about
that? Well, I don't have one right now. I had one about 10 years ago.
Okay.
And it was going great. And then the global economic meltdown took place, and that put a crimp in my style.
Okay.
But while I had it going, I was working with some of the top clothing lines in Tokyo, Mousy and Chubby Gang and Rudy's and all these different companies. I did motorcycle helmets for a place called Tachibana. And I did some work with a great punk rock band called 50 Kaitens. And it basically means 50 RPM. like the faster and louder.
Yeah.
One of the best live bands I've ever seen, and I did like three record covers for them. And they had me hand letter Japanese characters.
Oh, nice.
That was a lot of fun.
Because
I'm known for my hand lettering.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so doing it in Japan was like great.
Yeah.
And they had me over for a week, and they had a show with them and a band called Pony Camp. And who are the other guys? Radiance, that was it. Mm. Oh, what a great night.
Sounds fun.
Boy, I love Tokyo. I would live there in a minute if I could.
I've always wanted to go. I've never been.
But you do identify yourself as a cartoonist primarily.
Oh, yeah. Underground cartoonist, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I spent my whole career in independent or underground media, pretty much.
Right.
I mean, after when I stopped cartooning, it was to take a job at High Times magazine. Right. You know, that's not very corporate.
Yeah. Yeah. But you created the Joe comic strip for Scholastic, and the strip was also featured in a 2017 MoMA show created by Anne Magnuson, who was also featured in your latest newsletter, which we're going to get into in a little
bit. Oh, great. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, absolutely. But tell us about the MoMA show, because that looked very interesting.
Well, there's a place called Club 57 mm-hmm. back in the early 80s. Yeah, I think maybe opened in 79. And a couple of students from School of Visual Arts hung out there, mm-hmm. Kenny Scharf and Keith Haring. And they kind of took over the place. And so Anne, I think, sold the show based on the fact that they were, you know, frickin' frack. But she had all this other great stuff. There was a really big space. A lot of Haring and Scharf stuff, but a lot of the other weird ephemera, mm-hmm. like they had monster movie nights mm-hmm. and cartoons you won't see on TV. That's mm-hmm. what drew me to Club 57.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They would have these cartoon nights, and they'd show like Donald Duck in Nazi Land. Right. Ever see the one where he imagines he's a Nazi, right?
Wow, I've not seen that.
And Bugs Bunny nips the nips.
Oh, okay.
Where he fights. It's, you know, war cartoons really like on the edge.
Different time,
and dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, the Warner Brothers attempted to do cartoons aimed at a black audience. Mm-hmm. But now, mm-hmm. you know, people look at exaggerated caricatures of yeah. Cab Calloway and they think it's racist.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. A different time.
Well, people were more tolerant mm-hmm. of stuff like race back then, mm-hmm. you know? Like, you could make a joke about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But let's talk about the newsletter. Tell us how people can subscribe. And
johnholmstrom.substack.com. Just go to Substack, type in John Holmstrom. You can subscribe. I've been running the old Joe comic strips that I sold the first one in 75. And that's how I raised the money to rent the punk dump. Mm-hmm. Legs McNeil borrowed some money, and it was only $195 a month.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think we needed a month's rent and a month's security, so $400. Mm-hmm. We got this huge store, and we all lived there and put out the magazine.
So cool.
It's where the Hudson Yards project is now, and it's like the High Line and everything. They leveled the building. It's all gone.
Yeah, I was going to say, right. I'm sure it's not there anymore. That whole area is just, it's like another world. It doesn't even really feel like you're in Manhattan.
I feel like I'm in a Jetsons cartoon if I go up in that part of town.
Yeah.
And back in the day, you had all the S&M clubs around that neighborhood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
there would be like prostitutes walking around on, I think, 11th.
Yeah, the good old days.
But 10th was deserted.
Yeah.
10th Avenue, where we were.
Yeah.
Yeah. My next newsletter is going to be about Maggie's Bar.
Oh,
okay.
Maggie's Bar was around the corner from us.
Uh-huh.
And we met the owner, and then she opened up a place called Zepp's.
Uh-huh.
And we talked her into booking the Dictators. And she also ran a very famous bar called Tin Pan Alley.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It was in the Times Square area, and she was involved in putting together the Times Square show, mm-hmm. which introduced Haring and Basquiat and Scharf to the world. And it's kind of the hi-hat bar in this TV show, The Deuce.
Yeah, The Deuce.
Mm. Yes.
They and bought some clothes from us for the
really?
Show. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That is
yeah.
so cool.
Do you feel that show was pretty? Did you watch it?
I watched almost all of them, but it hooked me when I watched the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
And in one scene, they showed Screw Magazine, uh-huh. which is where I first got published.
Uh-huh.
And had a long association with. And then later on, they had a punk rock band play at the Hi-Hat.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like,
okay.
Hey, Screw Magazine,
yeah,
punk rock. They got it right.
Yeah. I feel like especially over the last few years, there's been so many movies and shows that have like tried to depict those time periods. And I wonder how much of it you watch and feel like that versus that's not that they didn't get that right.
Well, it's hard to say. I didn't hang out at Times Square back then.
Right.
It was
right.
too sleazy for me.
Okay.
You know, I don't like peep shows, but mm-hmm. you know, there were a lot of women who hung out at CBGBs who did work as strippers or mm-hmm. professional dominatrixes. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, even, I mean, I was doing work. My first published work was for Screw. Mm-hmm. So I was working in pornography right. and sex.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what kind of dominated the city back then. There were massage parlors everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
When I first came here.
How did you first get involved?
I applied for the job a couple times. I was dealing with the art directors or the editor. Manny Newhouse was the managing editor. We actually had a poker game going on up there for over 10 years.
Wow.
It was the sex, drugs, and gambling poker game. Because you had Screw and the art director at Swank, mm-hmm. Who started at Hustler
mm-hmm.
and actually did the infamous Hustler covers. He was the art director for those. And then I was the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a guy from the Racing Forum play, you know. So mm-hmm. That was the gambling end
right.
of it. And, you know, once in a while we'd, like, go to the track instead or
uh-huh.
go upstate and shoot guns. A lot of fun, man. You know, you got to hang out with people in porn.
A motley crew, yeah.
You know? If you're going to be uptight about sex... Later for you.
Right.
Yes,
right.
This is true.
But that's what rock and roll is about, right?
Right.
That's what,
yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
not punk rock so much. Punk was not that sexy, but you know, rock and roll, that's what it means, sex.
Mm-hmm. I remember seeing the movie before I moved here, Pandora's Box, a documentary about S&M clubs and dominatrixes in New York City. And for a minute I was like, that seems like an easy job. Maybe I'll move there and do that. I know it's not an easy job, but at the time I thought, hey, easy money. So just going back to the neighborhood, what do you see as a vision as what the East Village will become? Do you have one? Do you, based on the past?
You know, it's always with science fiction movies, they always make the mistake of assuming that everything happening now is just going to keep happening and it's just going to be more of the same. But who knows? Like, mm-hmm. We're not going in the right direction. There's that new mm-hmm. building going up
mm-hmm.
on the Bowery and mm-hmm. St. Mark's.
Mm-hmm.
We're losing our identity here in the village. Mm-hmm. But you got all the people who want to preserve it. So I don't know. I'm so old. Don't really care. I won't be here to see it.
Yeah, it feels like it's always been a clash of cultures. Yeah, I'm curious to see where things go. I always feel like when we were talking about when was the last phase of interesting music, feels like that hasn't happened in a really long time. I would like to think there'd be something else new that comes out at some point that's interesting.
Well, I'm working with Overthrow,
uh-huh.
the boxing
oh, yeah.
club mm-hmm. on Bleecker Street.
Yes.
And we're going to put together an event on August 24th.
Oh, cool.
And so hopefully we will find some of the up-and-coming punk rock bands.
Okay.
I think they even want some of the, there's some kind of rap music that's very influenced by punk rock right now.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, I would like to see music take a new direction
yes.
rather than mm-hmm. revisit the kind of stuff we did.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I thought there was a lot of great music coming out of the New York club scene in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
I was a big fan of the Bullies.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, the Bullies' main songwriter was also a firefighter.
Mm. Oh.
So he died on 9/11.
Oh, mm-hmm. wow.
Yeah, that kind of put a damper on things.
Yes.
But that I was trying to bring back the magazine in year 2000 because I thought, wow, there's really something happening here.
Mm-hmm.
But then that kind of killed it.
Mm. Yeah.
And then things started to come together, and then you had the global economic meltdown, and then things are coming together, and you end up with a COVID shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
And It seems like there's always something, some killjoy out there.
I agree with
spoiling
that.
Spoiling all the fun.
I agree with that. Every time you think you get a step ahead, you go 10 steps back mm-hmm. with some kind of killjoy. But Punk Magazine lives on.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, we'll have the website, and, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah, people, I did a book. I did the book Best of Punk Magazine, mm-hmm. which is still available. Mm-hmm. But people want to have the original magazine. You mm-hmm. know, they want to have the reprint. They want me to reprint the old magazine. So mm-hmm. maybe I can get it together before I die.
We have faith.
We do have to wrap up soon, but I did want to mention, John, your archives are actually housed in Yale University's Beinecke Library, and your work is also on display at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio, and in the permanent archives of the Museum of Modern Art. This is pretty good for a cartoonist, I would say.
Yeah, I'm surprised because I always just wanted to be a cartoonist, and I thought people would forget my stuff, and I'm okay with that. But it's okay being remembered. And what's kind of weird about the vintage clothing thing scene is, like, the images are what people are buying now. They're not buying the music. They're buying mm-hmm. the T-shirt.
Right, right.
Even if they don't know what it is.
The cartoonists yeah. and the artists are winning.
Yeah. Right, right. Well, it's just been great having you join us today, John. It seems like there's so much to cover in your career, and we've just scratched the surface, so maybe we can do another one sometime soon.
Part two. I'm ready.
Yeah. Yes.
For more information and to sign up for John's newsletter, go to johnholmstrom.com. And you can also go to punkmagazine.com for the latest news, archives, past issues, merch, and more. Copies of the latest Punk Magazine, which we talked about, are still available at iggypop.com. And that would include a CD of Iggy's latest and greatest solo album, Every Loser. Thanks again, John.
Oh, thanks for
thank
having
you,
me.
John.
This is fun. You got to come to the store on 12th Street.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This has been Alex Carpenter with Megan Haywood for Eye on the East Village. Thanks to Evie Grieve for letting us hold down the fort. You can come visit Megan and myself at East Village Vintage Collective here at 545 East 12th Street. That's between Avenue A and Avenue B. We are open Wednesdays through Fridays, 1 to 7. And Saturday and Sunday, 12 to 6. For more information, go to eastvillagevintagecollective.com or evvintagecollective on Instagram. And don't forget to subscribe to Eye on the East Village on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or live and direct on jasoncharles.net podcast network talk channel. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to
Eye on the East Village.
JasonCharles.net.
JasonCharles.net.
Deep talk, deep sounds.
Oh, wow. That's deep.